Welcome to The Art Informant. My name is Isabelle Humbert and I'll be your host. I have been working and breathing Islamic and Indian art history for more than a decade. How do you breathe art history, you ask? Listen to this podcast to find out.
Welcome to The Art Informant podcast. This is a very special episode to celebrate the 2-year anniversary of The Art Informant podcast. And to celebrate the release of Isabelle Humbert's new book, Les Tortues et les Deux Canards. I'm Stuart, and I will be your host. Who is Stuart, you ask? Listen to this podcast to find out. In this episode, we speak to Isabelle Humbert, doctor in Islamic art history, writer, art advisor, and podcast host. We discuss her career, her new book, and how it came to be, as well as future projects. We also talk about The Art Informant, covering the past, present, and the future of the podcast. As always, reproductions of artworks discussed and further links are available below the episode. Dr. Isabelle Humbert, welcome to the episode.
Thank you for having me.
For people familiar with the podcast, you may notice that Isabelle isn't hosting this time. So I guess the first question would be, how does it feel to be a guest instead of the host of your own podcast?
Well, so far it feels very weird, I'm not going to lie, especially because, well, first, because I've been doing this for 2 years, so usually I'm the one asking the questions, but also because it feels like self-promotion. And as you know, in academia, at least French academia, self-promotion isn't too much of a thing. We tend to feel quite uncomfortable with self-promotion. So we'll see how it goes.
It may be, let's say, taboo seems like too strong of a word. I would say your podcast, I'd say, well, advertising in academia.
Yeah, it's not a taboo, of course, but it's just, it has a kind of like a negative connotation to it. It's very bizarre. I'm not going to enter that particular discussion now, but it is how it is.
One for a future episode.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm going to try my best to host for the audience. So let's get started. A question for fans will be very familiar with at this point. How did you get started in Islamic art?
That is an excellent question. I started what it seems like a long time ago, right after I got my French baccalaureate, which is the diploma that you get at the end of high school, and I got to university to study art history. I always knew that I wanted to study art history. I don't know why I knew that I wanted to study art history, but yeah, it was an obvious choice for me. And so I started at the University of Toulouse Le Mirail, which is in south of France, where I grew up. And the day of the registration, there was a curriculum dedicated to art history with several courses. And then I had to pick an optional course, an optional class. And there was a huge catalog of classes that I could pick. And it was really comprehensive, let's say. I could have learned about the history of the circus. I could have learned about advanced math. I could have learned about anything. But the classes that caught my eye was actually a double class. It was the history of Byzantium and the history of the beginning of Islam. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. I know absolutely nothing about neither of those topics. So I'm going to pick up that class. And I did. And the teacher, I cannot remember the name of the teacher of the Byzantium history class. It was a great class. But the teacher for the history of early Islam was Professor Philippe Senac, who is an excellent, excellent teacher. He has the ability to explain really complicated concepts in a very approachable and easy to understand fashion. And he got me hooked, literally, I think. So I started with him. It was again a history class. It was not art history. But during the introduction class, he showed a coin, Umayyad coin, so early 8th century. And on that coin, the inscription was written in Arabic, but on the back, I don't have the terminology of the coin, but on the other side of the inscription, there was a portrait that looked like a Sasanian king portrait, so a Persian king, but which was in fact a depiction of the caliph. But it was this mix of origins, of styles, of iconography that I found completely fascinating. And it was a brand new world to me. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And then after that, I decided to stay in that field, and I left after 2 years. I left Toulouse for Paris, where I studied for the third year of my bachelor degree, then my master degree, and then my PhD, and Professor Jean-Pierre Van Stevel, who is an archaeologist, and Professor Héloïse Braque de la Perrière, who is an art historian. And, as they say, the rest is history.
It is indeed. Obviously, you've mentioned you picked those two courses, and obviously you've mentioned Philip as well. Are there any mentors or beyond that at that point that helped steer you or help you pick the direction you wanted to go in?
Well, Philippe Sénac, though he probably doesn't remember me, is a big one because in my first year, there was an oral exam at the end of the semester. It was on a topic picked at random where I had to do a little presentation. And the topic that I picked at random was pre-Islamic Arabian Peninsula. And so I did my little presentation, maps and everything. And at the end, he said, "You would be a great teacher." And that stayed with me for a very, very long time. And my second mentor, I would say, was, of course, Professor Héloïse Braque de la Perrière, who truly, truly put me on the path, the research path, I would say. I continued way after my getting my PhD. So I owe her a lot because she put me on the topic that we're going to discuss in a minute. She also involved me in her research programs, and that actually led to what we are going to discuss today, which is the publication of this children's book. So I owe her a lot, and I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah, I think they'd both be quite happy to see that it's come full circle with the podcast.
I don't know if it came full circle, but it's going in, I hope, in a positive direction.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, with the success of the podcast and everything else, the audience and myself would agree that we like the direction it's going.
Hopefully.
Speaking a bit more about your studies, in 2015, you got your PhD in Islamic art history from the Sorbonne in Paris, with a doctoral dissertation on floral paintings in Indian and Iran between the 16th and 18th century. So why did you choose to specialize in that topic for your PhD?
Yes, so I'm going to try to put this in a with a positive spin because the truth is, I was extremely reluctant choosing that topic. Professor Braque de la Perrière introduced me to that very topic during the first year of my master degree, and I said no because it was flower paintings. And it was not as exciting as other type of, let's say, figurative paintings, especially between the 16th and the 18th century in India and in Iran. In terms of painting, there is a lot happening and a lot exciting. And so she said, there is this topic, this subject. I think he has a lot of potential, and you would be the right person to carry it. And I said no. And I wrote my first year master degree memoir on a painter, Persian painter called Riza Abbasi. So slightly different topic, slightly different. And at the end of the first year of my master's degree, did my dissertation, and the topic was that subject on Riza Abbasi, and especially on Riza Abbasi's connection with the Armenian community of Isfahan, the capital of the Safavid Empire. That topic was, I couldn't continue. I couldn't pursue the field of inquiry. I didn't read or speak any Armenian. The topic was actually starting to be studied by other scholars. So yeah, it did not, it was not the right topic for me, or the right subject for me to continue studying. And again, Professor Braque de la Perrière came back and say, look into flower paintings, because there is a lot of potential. So I started doing some reading, and indeed I realized that it is an excellent research topic. It has so much connections with other larger topics, and larger fields of inquiry. It's really, really complex. It's not just flower paintings. It's a lot more. So in the end, I said yes, finally. So I did the second year of my master's degree on that very topic, and then a full PhD on it.
Amazing. Can you remember the first floral painting you saw that hooked you into that topic specifically?
I think, yes, actually, I do remember. It is the painting of an iris flower that is in the Brooklyn Art Museum, and that is wrongly attributed to a Persian painter called Muhammad Zaman. It's wrongly attributed in the exhibition catalogue held at the Louvre in 2007, called Le Champ du Monde. L'art sous les Safavids. So anyway, it was an exhibition dedicated to Safavid art, so Safavid Iran, and the exhibition was really big, but the catalog wasn't great. But there was this painting exhibited in this, and it's maybe it's not the first painting, the first flower painting that I saw, but it's the first one that I can remember seeing. So it was in 2007, so it was before I started my master's degree. It was the year I actually arrived in Paris, so I was still doing my bachelor degree. So it was way before. But yeah, and I wrote about that painting quite at length in my dissertation later on.
Yeah, it sounds like it must have been I don't know, a particularly striking painting or picture that's got you hooked.
Not even, no.
Yeah.
not really. It's a very, obviously, for the audience, I will put the reproduction of that painting in others under the episode, but it's a very simple iris with a full with a an open bird and a closed bird on a plain background. So it's very simple, but it's very detailed. It's actually really, it's high quality painting, definitely. But it's absolutely not 17th century. It's more most likely end of 18th, beginning of 19th century, in my opinion.
With that then, in 2018, you became an independent advisor after completing your PhD. And you've worked with several auction houses. You published academic papers and articles, advised private collectors across the globe, spoken at several symposiums, and even created the Art Informer podcast, which we're listening to now. So since 2018, for people that have heard you on the podcast, what are some of your career highlights up until this point?
This is where, we come back to self-promotion and feeling awkward about it. So indeed, I got my PhD in 2015. Then I took a kind of an extended break from art history in general for multiple reasons. But yeah, in 2018, I decided I wanted to work a little bit here and there, but without committing too much to neither, which has worked quite well actually. Career highlights. The first that comes to mind is my collaborations with Anne-Sophie Jean-Coupil-Orger, who is the head of the Oriental and Indian department at Milan Auction in Paris. Anne-Sophie was a guest on this very podcast back in 2021. So a while back, she was the second guest of this podcast. And she's a great friend. And in 2018, she asked me to support her with a research on a manuscript, a Shahnameh manuscript, made for or dedicated to the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. It was sold at auction by Anne-Sophie. But it was a very, very interesting manuscript because it had flower paintings in it that were copied from other sources. So very, very intriguing manuscript. I don't know who he it has been sold to. Of course, these kind of informations are confidential, but I hope this manuscript will reappear in exhibitions because it's fascinating volume. And I think that was pretty much my first collaboration with her, my first kind of I want to say almost official collaboration with her. And since then we've been working together. In 2019, I think it was 2019, we worked together again on a page of the Pachanama, which are the chronicles of the reign of the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan. And that page was unpublished. It had been bound in an album, a very, very famous album. And then obviously the page had been detached at some point. And that was a true discovery that she made. And I was extremely honored that she asked me to help her with research and the writing of the description. That was definitely a highlight because there are so much of these kind of objects that can appear on the market. So being associated to one of those is a true privilege. Of course, I published a few papers, not that many, but also a recent highlight that is hopefully the beginning of something was the panel that I co-organized with Teresa Zichkin, who is a young PhD candidate in the University of Munich. We co-organized a conference panel on figurative margins in Persianate manuscripts and with three other wonderful scholars. And we delivered those papers this summer at the 10th Conference of Iranian Studies in Leiden. And so hopefully this will be published at some point. Academic publication takes some time, but we will definitely publish that. And hopefully that will lead to a bigger project. We have lots of ideas on that, so more to come, but that was a phenomenal moment. And I'm very proud of this panel. It was really cool. And after that, so many actually. I have so many highlights because I enjoy every small and big project, every collaboration with auction houses, with private collectors. I enjoy every part of it because I have this kind of privileged position where I am neither fully in academia, neither fully on the market. I'm a little bit in between, so I can do a lot of different things and have these connections and these relationships with a lot of different actors of the field. And obviously the podcast has helped massively there. So yeah, lots of highlights.
Yeah, and I think if you could probably speak to yourself now in 2018 and see what you've done, I think you'd you'd be pretty excited to look forward to working on that. So
Yeah.
yeah, that's a really, really amazing career so far, and I'm sure that a lot more is going to come your way.
Hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. With that then, we will jump into the focus of this episode, which is the release of your new children's book, which is called Les Tortues et les Deux Canards. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate you. I'm sure I won't be the first person, but just to congratulate you on the release of your book.
Thank you.
With that, let's look at the origins and the background of the book. So, the book itself is a collection of fables originally written by Jean de La Fontaine. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. And it's also connected to Khalil Wadimna, and those two are meshed together. So the first question I should ask is, who is Jean de La Fontaine?
So I feel like I need to give an additional context to this book because the audience of the podcast is not necessarily going to understand why it is linked to Islamic art and Islamic art history. But we're going to talk about that in a minute, obviously, in more details. But basically, indeed, as you mentioned, this is a book of fables written by the French writer Jean de La Fontaine. So you had the pronunciation correct, or almost correct. And these fables are connected to Kalila Wadimna, which are fables written by Ibn al-Muqaffa in the 8th century Iraq. So there is indeed a connection between those French fables, very, very French fables, and Islamic literature and Islamic arts. So we'll come back to that in a minute, but I feel like it was important to give that additional context. So to come back to your question, who was Jean de La Fontaine? Jean de La Fontaine was born near Paris in 1621. He came from a family of merchants that became a noble family at some point. He studied in Paris. He became a lawyer, but he also, during his study, he met a lot of people, and he kind of like built a network. At the end of his study in 1649, he realized that he had absolutely no interest for his job and like the official functions he had been given. And so in 1653, he decided to abandon that official career and became a poet. And in a few years later, only 5 years later, in 1658, he started working as a poet for the crown, for the official court of Louis the 14th, who was at the time in Versailles. He worked for several people at the court. I'm not going to get into details. But well, during his career as a poet, he wrote fables and he wrote 240 fables. It took him 20 years to write all these fables. So these fables are very, very well known in France, but not all of them, obviously, because there are 240. So anyway, so to finish about his life, we'll come back to the fables in a minute, I'm sure. So he wrote these fables in three volumes. He continued to write these fables until 1692. So quite late in his life, since that's the year when he became ill, and he stopped writing fables and he started writing religious texts, religious literature. And finally, he died in Paris in 1695. So that's for a very short summary of his life.
240 fables is it's a lot of writing, a lot of fables. Obviously you've mentioned that they are tied to French culture. So what is it particular about his fables that are so important to French culture?
So obviously these fables are written in French. That goes without saying. Part of these fables, or some of these fables, are known by every French person who ever attended school, pretty much. So pretty much everybody, because school is mandatory. So because those fables, or some of those fables, are taught to kids, you have to in school, you have to learn them by heart, and then you have to recite them in front of the class. Well, at least that's how I did it. I don't know how it's done today, but it's fully part of the education of children in France. So you can ask every French person and they will be able to recite at least part of one of these fables, if not more, if they have a good memory. Jean de La Fontaine is part of the corpus of French literature, fully part. What is kind of funny is that these fables were never intended for children. For a young audience, they were written for adults, they were written for the members of the court and for the king. So they are very complicated, those fables. So the one that children nowadays, well, children now learn are the simple ones with a simple moral, a simple story. But the one that are in the book, in my book, are actually really complicated. And when the book came out, and friends in France bought the book, they started reading it, and then they were like, I don't understand what I'm reading. It's so complicated. I have to like research the vocabulary. And that was one of the challenge of actually this book. But because again, yeah, these fables were not written for children, and they were written for like an adult audience with adult ideas. So some of the fables actually are a bit racy, let's say, in like very 17th century way, but still. So they're not all adapted to children at all.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to the experience we have in the UK with Shakespeare, this taught in English, and some of the themes and the topics they cover in those books are very, let's just say, adult in nature. So I can see how they may have made it into schools. With that, how is Kelly O'Dimner and Shaun de La Fontaine connected?
So that's going to be a long answer, so bear with me. But this is where it becomes interesting, right? And I'm going to try to have a very clear and not too long answer. So first of all, we need to talk about fables a little bit as a literature genre. Fables, as some of you may or may not know, are short stories involving animals who go through adventures and challenges, and at the end of these short stories, there's always a lesson, a moral intended for the reader. So fables have a really long tradition. There were most likely oral transmissions until they were put into writing. So one of the first person to put these fables, or put fables into writing, was a guy called Aesopus, who lived in Greece in the 8th century BC. He's usually known as the inventor of the fable, but most likely he put, again, in writings, the fables and the stories that he had heard during his life. Knowing that, we can talk a little bit more about Kalila Wadimna and Ibn Mukaffa. So Kalila and Dimna are two jackals who go through ventures and challenges, and again, lots of stories within stories as well, which is kind of a characteristic of this kind of text. These fables of Kalila Wadimna actually came from an Indian text called the Panchatantra, which was written, I think, in the 3rd century BC. Don't quote me on this. and which was then translated in Middle Farsi, Middle Persian, and later on in Arabic by Ibn al-Mukaffa. I'm not going to give you the full history of Kalila wa Dimna. I highly recommend for that you check the podcast episode with Annie Vernet-Nourry and Aïda El-Khiari on this very, very topic. So, in a nutshell, Ibn al-Mukaffa wrote Kalila wa Dimna in the 8th century in Iraq. And that text encountered a massive success. It was like a bestseller of the 8th century. And it was translated in many languages, starting with Hebrew, and then Greek for the Byzantium Emperor, and then Old Spanish, Old German, and of course in Latin, and from there in French. Also, in parallel, it was also translated in Farsi and in Turkish with small adaptations. Well, not necessarily small, actually, with adaptations and rewrites of the text. Those Latin and French translation arrived, obviously, on Jean de La Fontaine's desk, I would say. And Jean de La Fontaine really took some of those fables, some of them completely verbatim. He maybe changed a little bit the animals, but the stories remain. Some other he rewrote. And he rewrote in the taste of the court, the French court in the 17th century. But really, 20-odd fables are directly linked to Kalila wa Dimna through all the translations that the text has known. So this is a very surprising connection between Jean de La Fontaine and Ibn al-Mukaffa. But it is what makes this book project so interesting.
That's fascinating, and it also makes you wonder what changes ran through his mind at the time between the original source and his interpretation of it as well.
Well, the thing is, Jean de La Fontaine never. Most likely never read the original material. He read the translations of it, right? Because Jean de La Fontaine didn't know Arabic. So he never read Kalila wa Dimna in the Arabic text. He read translations of translations. So obviously the core of the text and the core of the stories remained, but obviously the vocabulary and some of the situation, some of the context changed. And then he added his own creative spin on these stories. So some of them again are very close to the original material, and some are very actually difficult to identify.
That's fascinating. I can't imagine where you would begin to even try to match those, but it's definitely something I assume people have researched and looked in, and a good
Actually,
place to start your book.
no, absolutely. My book is based on other people's research, clearly. So first and foremost, the collective book edited by Annie Vernet-Nourry, Héloïse Braque de la Perrière, and Aïda El-Khiari, which is the topic of the podcast episode I just mentioned. But also my book is also based on the work of other scholars, such as Fernand Bassan, who wrote on comparatist literature, as well Patrick Dandré, same comparatist literature, and Mohamed Hajjaj Aoun, who wrote as well on this very topic, the topic of La Fontaine's fables and their origin, their quote-unquote Oriental origin. So a lot of other people, smarter people than me, worked on that topic, and my book owed them a lot.
For people reading this book, the first thing they will notice, and it's something we mentioned earlier in the podcast, is Jean de La Fontaine and Kalila wa Dimna are connected. So in the book, you will notice there are fables and illustrations in there. For the listeners at home, how are they linked? So how are the illustrations and the stories linked, in this book in particular?
Yes. So it's a whole point of the book, really. It's the connection between the text and the illustrations. The text are, of course, 10 fables of Jean de La Fontaine that originated in Kalila Wadimna. So that's clear. But each fables is associated with one or more images that are actually paintings from manuscripts, so either Arabic, Persian, Indian, or Turkish manuscripts of either Kalila Wadimna or one of its translation, especially the Persian translation, which is Anvar Esueli. And the idea of the book was really to associate visually Jean de La Fontaine and Kalila Wadimna in the original material through the use of the imagery existing in manuscript created between the 13th and the 18th century. So this is why when you look at the cover of the book is called La Tortue et les deux canards, the turtle and the two ducks, which is a fable by Jean de La Fontaine, but which and is also in Kalila Wadimna. And the cover of the book has the title, and then it has an edited version of a Persian painting made in the 16th century of the same fable, but it's translated in Persian as part of Anvar Esueli. So, yes, it's fables, but it's also really a visual experience and a visual journey through history with Jean de La Fontaine and with Kalila Wadimna and its translations.
And from I would say a reader's perspective as well, I imagine that's really cool to almost see the inspiration, because it will obviously add more to the fables as you're reading them throughout the book.
Exactly. And also, as I mentioned, because the fables are not necessarily easy to read, you can always look at the images and enjoy beautiful paintings from different manuscripts.
Yeah, it's definitely one to revisit. Amazing.
If you're enjoying this episode, please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite audio platform and give a rating. Add a comment and share on social media to help grow the audience and the community. To support the initiative, buy the host a coffee via the link under the episode. And now, back to the interview.
Moving on to the process, and almost the timeline of the book. So, how did this book and this project come to be?
Well, like I think anything in my life, a bit by chance. I was contacted by the publishing house, which is Versant Sud Jeunesse, which is a Belgium publishing house. I was contacted in June 2022 by the editor, Elisabeth Jongen, who pretty much found my website, on which I have a small summary of my work as part of the research project led by Professor Héloïse Braque de la Perrière and Dr. Annie Vernet-Nourry on Kalila Wadimna, and more especially the Arabic manuscripts of Kalila Wadimna. And so she found me. That's the magic of the internet. And she got in touch with me. And then I said yes, pretty much right away. I was like, yeah, why not? I've never done a children's book, so it's great, a great idea. And we started working together.
How long did it take for this book to come together? So you mentioned you started in June 2022.
Yeah, it took a little bit more than a year, really. So it was a fast process compared to what we know of, well, what I know of academic publications, what I'm used to, which can take a decade to just publish one paper. This was actually a really fast and efficient process. So it started with the selection of the fables. which was not a small task because, again, these fables are complicated and they're not, yeah, necessarily easy for children to read. So I started with the selection of the fables, and then we moved on to the selection of images, and that was also not a small task. Luckily, there are some online databases that are dedicated to this kind of projects, so that was very, very convenient. But and then there was a fantastic work done by the graphic designer. Who really reworked the images. Some are in very old manuscripts, not in the best condition. So he reworked the images. So obviously, and almost as a disclaimer, the images that are in the book are all slightly, or they're all retouched, right? Because yeah, some were really not in good condition. And so the graphic designer did a phenomenal job really adapting those illustrations to, well, the format of this book. So that took a long time. And then came the writing of the additional texts, because of course there are 10 fables in the book. There are also explanatory texts at the end of the book, which again, tell a little bit more about who was Jean de La Fontaine, what is Kalila Wadimna, why these two things are connected. There is also a kind of family tree, a summarized family tree of the different translations of Kalila Wadimna. So starting with actually the Panchatantra, which is the Indian original text, going through Kalila Wadimna, some of the main translations to, in the end, Jean de La Fontaine. So for the reader to be able to really understand the genealogy of the text. So all this I wrote, then it went to the print, the printing press, pretty much.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so it was a very, very quick, very fast process with a fantastic team, whom I wish to thank here, because it's been a fantastic project and a really, really great collaboration. So yeah, thank you to the team in Versant Sud Jeunesse.
And it seems to me as well with the addition of the, as you mentioned, the family tree that shows the history of these stories, you're really trying to introduce people to these fables, but also create let's say future art historians by trying leave them branches that they can look into further. So it's a really
Hopefully.
nice touch.
Well, I think it was essential, to be honest, because the connection between Jean de La Fontaine and Arabic literature is not known at all in France. So it was necessary to explain the concept of the book, really, because otherwise, why would you buy yet another book of fables of Jean de La Fontaine? Everybody has at least one at home. So it was very important to spend some time and some care into giving the context for these fables and how they came to be and why we chose those 10.
Something that most people who are writers or students who aspire to write will probably be wondering, what was the moment like when you discovered the book was out? So you'd written it, it was out, and you knew people could purchase the book like Amazon or even in bookstores.
It's a difficult question because I'm a, how can I put this? I'm eternally looking for the next thing. So I'm never completely satisfied. And it's like truly something that I'm working on, right? It's like living in the moment and all these kind of things. So it was a great moment knowing that it was out, especially when I received my copies. It was fantastic to have it, with me and have the physical copy after working on it for a long time. But then, of course, I was like, okay, what now? What else? Are we doing a volume two? What are we doing now? But so it was a kind of a, and also because it's my first book, my first actual book published, so it was a bit of a split between a pinch me moment, very like moment of true excitement, and also a moment of thinking ahead. So it was a lot of emotions at once.
Well, now that it's out, I've seen the book. I said French, so because that's not my my native language, I can't say that I've read it, but I've seen it. It looks beautiful.
Thank
And if anyone's listening to this podcast that hasn't already, and you want to support the podcast, please go out, purchase the book, read it, share it, because there's a lot of effort that's gone into there that can be seen in every page in terms of design and things like that. Also, if you have already purchased it, please share it with the Artinform and Instagram and Isabel's Instagram as well, because it's always good to hear from people that are enjoying the book and have really taken it in. So, moving on to something everyone will be familiar with if they are listening to this. Would be the Art Informant podcast, a podcast she started in 2021. So we're celebrating 2 years of the podcast now. How did the podcast actually get started? So how did that come to be?
It was a bit of a gamble, really. The idea didn't come from me, actually came from you. So thank you for that. And I was not completely convinced at the beginning by it, but because it's something that was new, I've never done it before, that's something that is not really common in the field, at least in that format, very kind of informal and very diverse format. And so the idea of this podcast indeed originated in 2021. So we were still more or less in the pandemic. It was difficult to meet people, it was difficult to build those connections. And also, there was a lot happening at that time on the art market in particular. Obviously, in research, there is always a lot happening. But on the art market and on the Parisian art market, it felt like a very, very dynamic moment. So, really, I started this podcast thinking, you know what, well, let's do one episode and see how it goes. And so the first episode was with Romain Pengano and Camille Cellier for the first auction at Art Curial, which was the auction of the collection of the late Marie-Christine David, who was a great, great expert of Islamic art on the French art market. Ironically, this episode is a bit dated now because Romain and Camille parted ways. They're now working for different auction houses, but you know, I'm still I still like it a lot because it is a moment in time. And anyway, so yeah, I started with one episode, kind of like came together with some questions and recorded, and we did it like that. And then I was like, okay, that's cool, that works. Let's do a second one. So with Anne-Sophie Joncoupil-Auger, who I mentioned earlier, because she had an auction coming, and so on and so forth. And in the end, yeah, I just kept going because I kept talking to new people and kind of like learning about new people that I didn't know. And being interested in what they were doing. But the idea really of this podcast, to conclude on that very longer answer, was to give a platform to the actors of Islamic art history, like Islamic art in general, right? And I wanted to give that platform in a bit of yeah, a different format than what we are used to, whether it is on the market or in academia, which is always very formal, it's always very codified. And obviously, this podcast, the questions are written in advance. There is no bad surprises for the guest, but the idea is to have a conversation about what they do and how they do it. Because again, especially academics, we know what they work on via the communications they give in symposiums or the paper they write. But how did they get to that point? How did they get to the research paper? How did they get to write the book, right? That's the thing that I wanted to understand and learn a little bit more about the people themselves who really contribute to Islamic and Indian art history as it is today.
And I think as well, from at least what you said there, it's quite obvious that when people write these things, you also lose the almost the passion and the hard work that they put into it, and it really comes across in some of the episodes how much people love these subjects or these topics that they choose in particular, and I think it's something that you, at least from listening to it, that's what I always gravitate to. So, I mean, since you started this podcast in 2021, is there anything that you wish you knew when you started the podcast that you know now for anyone out there?
To come back first on your previous comment, I think it's absolutely spot on, right? I think art history, art market, conservation, all these fields of, again, Islamic art history are truly led by passion and also a hard work, really, really hard work. And this podcast wanted to recognize that both the passion and the hard work that goes into anything that is published, any auction that is, presented to the public, there is a lot of work that goes into it and a lot of love. So hopefully this podcast kind of highlights these two elements. I've learned a lot. I've learned to prepare, but not over prepare. I've learned that there is no stupid questions. I've learned as well to match the energy of the guests. And that's not an easy, necessarily an easy thing to do. So if someone is very formal, I will be formal with them. If someone is more on the relaxed side, we'll have, some jokes and some things like that. And I've learned to prepare interview questions in a very, very basic way. So to do very like basic research and because I tend to invite people who work on topics that I know nothing about, I have to research a little bit. So I have to work fast and I have to work a little bit smart, but also give the opportunity to people to speak as much as they want. So in the end, I have very long episodes. And I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I don't want to cut people off because time is running out, especially when they talk about, again, a topic they're passionate about and that they spend so many years, decades even, working on and preparing. I've learned so much.
Yeah, I suppose that probably should have been my first question as a guest host. With that, you've mentioned that you like to listen to people speak. Me in particular, as a fan of the podcast, I have listened to every episode. I mean, some of my favorites. I enjoyed the Beatrice Campy one a lot when she was talking about the auction. I am also enjoy one of my favorites, the one with Dorina Michaelis. That's one of my favorite episodes. But do you have any favorite guests or episodes, or are you not allowed to say?
I am allowed to say it's my podcast. But it's hard. It's a very difficult question because I really love all the episodes and I really loved recording them all equally. Now in terms of favorite, it's really hard to say. The one with Beatrice I particularly love because it was the beginning of a friendship. It was I think the first time we spoke was when recording that podcast. And we kept in touch and we see each other every time I'm in London and yeah, I consider her as a friend. The one with Anne-Sophie, of course, was a great episode because, again, we've been friends for decades, and it's fantastic. The episode with Axel Langer, I enjoyed the conversation and the discussion on the status of image in Islam and Christianity in particular. So we talked about Byzantium, and we talked about like many topics that I absolutely love. The one with Davinder too, fantastic because he's such a pleasant person to talk to. He has a phenomenal collection, obviously, and he was fantastic talking to a collector. And he's generally an amazing person to talk to. Who else? Oh my God, this is hard. The one with Rachel Parikh. We had such a good conversation that I had to split the episode in two because we couldn't stop talking. Who else? The one with Hiba Abid, because Hiba and me, we've known each other for years, and we hadn't talked to each other for, again, years. So it was kind of like catching up with an old friend. It was fantastic. The one with Barty Lalwani and Nicola Roth, because it was very different because it was on a different type of project and fantastic. So yeah, I can tell you about all the episodes, really. I absolutely looking at the list of all the episodes, I'm very, very proud of all of them, and very grateful to the guests, obviously, to have accepted to participate and talk about what they do and how they do it. And yeah, no, all the episodes are fantastic, if I say so myself.
Yeah, I think you've covered a lot of great topics as well, and at least in the last year, you've definitely broadened from more than art to cooking and even soaps, which is particularly interesting. Another episode I'd like to shout out is the one with Rim. I particularly enjoyed that because it was about the opening of an auction
Yeah,
house
with
and
the Rim
almost the
Mezgani,
beginning.
yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, and that's you rarely get to see the beginning of something that will have an influence in at least the French art market for the foreseeable future. So
Absolutely.
things like that are really, really interesting. That I think that comfortably leads into the next point I wanted to cover, which was who would you like to have on the podcast in future, or what would you like to cover? So what topics or subjects would you like to cover in future episodes?
So, first of all, one topic that we're going to cover actually early next year, so spoiler alert, is sub-Saharan Africa and Muslim architecture in sub-Saharan Africa, especially the Swahili coast, with Professor Stéphane Pradin. I'm very excited about this episode, very, very excited because I know nothing about sub-Saharan Africa. So I had to research quite a lot to write the questions, but I'm very, very excited about it because it's an important topic. Obviously, there are a lot of Muslim communities in sub-Saharan Africa with a very long tradition of artistic creations, and it's kind of considered as the margins of the Islamic world. And I think it's incorrect, really, to classify it that way. So I'm very excited to bring that topic a little bit to light. And what I would like to really do is have more art market experts on the podcast. And I don't know if I should say that, but I'm going to say it regardless. I would really, really love to have people from Sotheby's, Christie's, and Bonhams on the podcast. But it's not easy because, first, this podcast is kind of a modest, a humble little podcast. It's not a big communication thing. So they might not be interested. And also, I have been very critical of these auction houses in my blog post, commenting on the Islamic weeks in particular. So I'm not completely sure they will be interested to come on the podcast. after I write every season that I need to be more serious with provenance and so on. So I would really, really love to have Christie Sosby's and Bonham's people, but yeah, we never know. You never know.
Well, if anyone from Sotheby's, Bonhams, Christie's is listening, we're coming for you. You will be on the podcast at some point. Please.
Don't scare them away.
No, this is obviously it's a great platform. I'm sure people are that have been on it previously will attest to that. And obviously people in future that will be on there. So I think we're in for some amazing episodes coming up next year. So for anyone listening, stay tuned. With that then, let's jump into future projects. So as we covered at the beginning, you're an independent advisor. You work with people, well, different art houses, supporting them with auctions, with private collectors. You have done symposiums, you published papers, you've published a book. In future, you've kind of touched on it from a podcast perspective, but who would you like to collaborate with in future? So are there any institutions, academies, like auction houses, beyond the podcast you would like to work with moving forward?
Well, anybody really. I go with the flow. In general, when it comes to collaborating with auction houses, institutions, private collectors, I go with the flow. Yeah, because I don't have a very kind of structured approach to my work as an independent. You know, people contact me and I say yes. And you know, that's how the book came to be, for instance. So anybody who wants to collaborate on a project, you know, I'm absolutely open to that. I don't have a particular goal set in my mind because I am an independent and I have the immense privilege of doing what I like. My options are fully open.
Is don't close any doors, I guess.
Exactly. Say yes and see what happens. Worst case scenario, things, you know, don't end up being successful and you've wasted a bit of time. That's the worst case scenario. But even if that happens, you learn something in the process. And the next time you'll do slightly differently for better results. So everything is a learning experience, even if projects don't turn out well or successful. Doesn't matter. You learn something in the process, and the next one will be more successful for
That's great advice for anyone that's listening out
it.
there.
Or maybe not, I
There's,
don't know.
well, no, it definitely is. It's always daunting to try something new, and the best way to learn is to do things and try them. So, I think, for anyone listening that's either a student or they're really sure about trying something, they definitely should just try it, see if it works. The worst thing that can happen is you learn something, then just try again. So we're getting to the end of the episode. Some people might be grateful not to hear me hosting anymore, but Isabel will be hosting next week. With that in mind, what is your favorite piece of Islamic art?
I like that question, because usually people kind of like struggle to answer it, but I won't, because my favorite piece of Islamic art are actually three pieces, I think. One in the David collection, one in the Louvre, one in the Museum of Islamic Art in Istanbul. There might be others. And it's literally the logo of the podcast. So my favorite piece of Islamic art are three that I know of, door handles that are in cast and engraved bronze. and that were most likely made in southeastern Turkey in the beginning of the 13th century. And these door handle that show two dragons standing against each other. And I particularly love these pieces because they are, first of all, they're beautiful, they're absolutely gorgeous design. But there is an extremely complex intellectual substrate to those dragons with a loop in their tail. That makes reference to astronomy. I'm not going to get into too much details, but for me, these door handles really summarize the first of all the beauty of what we consider Islamic art, because again, they're just, to me at least, absolutely gorgeous, but also the why Islamic art is such an amazing field of inquiry, why it's so complex and intellectual, and there are so many things to study and understand. And yeah, I'm losing a bit my words here, but those door handles are my favorite piece of Islamic art.
Well, maybe one day, a private collector might thank you and
Give
buy
me one.
those.
Yeah. Please give
Yeah.
me one. And what I would like to do is have an episode dedicated to those that particular imagery, because again, it's linked to cosmography and astronomy, and that is very, very fascinating and important topic in Islamic art history in general. So hopefully at some point we'll have an episode on that. But I need to find the right person to talk to. More to come.
Yeah, maybe they're listening now. Who
Hopefully. Get
knows?
in touch.
Reach out. Yeah. And normally the last question would be, what is your favorite piece of art? But as a guest host, I did promise I would reveal my identity. So to the audience, who is the guest host known as Stuart?
I have to answer that.
Yeah.
Well, you're my husband.
Oh. Well, there you go.
was the last
Mystery.
question.
That's the last question. Yeah. First of all, I'd just like to thank you, obviously, for your time, and
Thank
obviously
you.
sharing. And again, I'd just like to thank everyone for bearing with me as a host. Hopefully I made you all proud. And next episode will be Isabel hosting. With that, bye everyone.
Thank you for listening to The Art Informant. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on your favorite audio platform, add a rating, and share around you to grow the community. Do not forget to follow The Art Informant on Instagram to receive all the podcast updates, and I will see you in the next episode.